Our second case this morning is United States against McCracken. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Lieutenant Greg Manns, and I represent the appellant, Sergeant Chad McCracken. The first issue in this case is whether the lower court erred by affirming a lesser-included offense. The first issue is whether the lower court erred by affirming a lesser-included offense based on a theory of criminality not offered or presented by the government at trial. As a starting point, an accused has a right to know the specific charge against him and any lesser-included offenses, and is a violation of due process for an appellate court to affirm a conviction based on a charge that was neither alleged in the indictment nor presented to the jury at trial. That's exactly what the lower court did here. As a result of the lower court's opinion, Sergeant McCracken was convicted of a charge that he had no notice of and had no reason to present a defense against.
Is it the charge or the theory that is at the root of your case?
It's the theory of the charge.
Here we're talking. Because you're not contesting that the third party observing sex thing might not could constitute an LIO.
Yes, open and notorious conduct could be an LIO if it was pled properly.
So, and would if the government had argued this theory in the alternative during the case, you would argue that he would be on notice that LIO was in play?
The appellant's first position is that open and notorious sexual conduct is not an LIO of rape when pled in the short form. So the first position is that, no, had the government attempted to argue that open and notorious fornication or sexual conduct was an LIO, it would have been proper for the defense to object and the military judge to deny that LIO to the prosecution.
It would not be, it is not necessarily an LIO, or it is an LIO in no case?
It is not necessarily an LIO. However, Article 79 allows an LIO with an added element or added aggravating factor to be an LIO if included in the specification.
Okay, it's not an LIO of what? Rape?
Of rape or indecent assault. Open, there are different theories of indecent
assault. An indecent act isn't an LIO of indecent assault.
Theory of open and notorious fornication is not necessarily an LIO of either, no, Your Honor.
No, that's not what I'm asking.
Of that.
Yeah, okay. Indecent act an LIO of indecent assault?
It can be.
It can.
Some theories of indecent acts are necessarily an LIO. Other theories are only an LIO if pled properly.
All right. Now, why isn't the fact, yeah, leaving aside who was in the room and threw his alarm clock at the door.
Yes, sir.
The fact that the act was committed in a public, semi-public, and in an area in which the presence of others might reasonably be expected. Isn't that enough for an indecent act?
The appellant agrees that the facts as on the record would be legally sufficient to constitute an open and notorious act.
Okay, and what is the problem?
The problem here is notice. Whether Sergeant McCracken was on notice that he would have to defend against a consensual act committed in public or with a third party present. And there is nothing in the specification was a short form allegation of rape. There is nothing in that specification that would put him on notice that he would need to defend against an additional factor of rape, additional factor of third-party presence or that it occurred in public. To put it another way.
Well, wait a minute. Is what you're complaining of the fact that you're saying he didn't have notice that he would have to defend against it being open and notorious?
Yes.
Or that it was consensual?
Arguably both, but we're mainly focused. The main point of contention is the open and notorious element.
Okay, he was not on notice that he would have to defend against the open and notorious.
Yes, Your Honor. Because open and notorious is not necessarily included in the greater offense. To put it another way, one does not need to commit an open and notorious act in order to commit the greater offense of rape or the greater offense of indecent assault. There is an extra, additional fact or element that's required for its lesser included offense. So just by viewing the pleading elements approach, looking at the elements, there is a different element involved in the lesser offense. So a short form pleading of rape would provide no notice whatsoever for that additional effect.
Did it put him on notice of the indecent assault?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's an LIO of rape.
Of rape, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Indecent assault is an LIO of rape in that there's a force element to it, but the act itself just falls short of intercourse.
Right.
So the elements are necessarily included in indecent assault.
Counsel, what case would you cite for the proposition upon which you appear to rely? The proposition upon which you appear to rely is that if at trial, in this case, the prosecution had asked for an instruction on the indecent act of committing a sexual act in the presence of others, the defense would have been able to object and have that objection sustained. And even though the indecent act was an enumerated lesser included offense. So which case do you rely on for the proposition that under those circumstances the prosecution could not get the instruction?
For a specific language from this court that states that open and notorious fornication is not an element of rape, we would point to Hickson and Schoolfield. For a factual scenario that's almost identical, we would invite the court's attention to U.S. v. King, which was an Army Court of Criminal Review case, which involved a short form of rape. And during trial, the appellant, or the accused at the time, testified that there was third party present in the room. At that moment, the government stood up and requested an instruction for the LIO, open and notorious conduct. The military judge in that case granted the motion, and on appeal, the Army Court of Military Review held that that was improper and there was no notice of the open and notorious conduct, and it was error to grant that as an LIO in the short form of rape. That case is nearly identical, nearly on point to this. While it's an Army Court of Military Review, the appellant would invite this court to consider it. Mainly, it comes down to notice and where is notice found. Typically, notice is found in the statute or in the pleading. Here, there is nothing in the statute that talks about open and notorious conduct, and there is nothing in the pleading that talked about open and notorious conduct. So there was no notice from the beginning of trial, from the pleading, or from the statute.
Now you argue in your reply brief that case law cannot provide notice. Do you mean ever or in this case? Certainly, could not a case say X is necessarily an LIO of Y?
Well, I believe.
And if it did that, would not that provide notice that X is an LIO of Y?
I believe. Without having more facts for that case, I believe
X and Y are not sufficient.
I don't believe a case would find something to be necessary in LIO if it wasn't necessarily included. It's founded in the military. We have Article 79, and the court that held, for like Schoolfield, held that indecent assault is an LIO of rape and indecent act.
Okay, so would that not give notice? Schofield would give notice to someone that indecent assault was an LIO of rape, would it not?
The case isn't giving notice. The fact that the elements are included in the greater offense is what provides notice, not the case itself.
All right, that's a tricky argument.
So the reason the case came out that way is because the elements were lesser included or necessarily included. So the appellant wouldn't have to go find a Schoolfield, they would look at the elements and that would provide the notice.
Okay, fair enough. But in this case, that's not this case in any event, putting X and Y aside.
No, Your Honor. This is just one potential theory of indecent acts. There may be other theories of indecent acts that were not at issue that could potentially be out there in case law somewhere. It's not the burden of the appellant to independently discover and research every potential theory of indecent acts to try to find out what it is. That's why we have pleadings. That's why we have notice. The whole point of the pleading elements approach is so you know what an LIO is and you know what you need to defend against. Here, we don't have notice from the statute. We don't have notice from the pleading. So it's completely absent. So from the beginning, there was no notice. Even if we want to assume that the statute did provide notice, at trial, the government didn't even attempt to prove this offense. So even if the government had the option to do so, they either decided not to or just failed to do so. They did not argue during their opening that third-party presence could be an indecent act. They did not put the roommates on as witnesses, nor did they, in their closing argument, argue that third-party presence could be an indecent act. And the jury instruction...
Well, you're talking about third-party presence here as opposed to open and notorious conduct, which might be revealed to third parties. That's two different things. Yeah, they didn't argue third-party presence.
I mean, people would say that open and notorious conduct encompasses third-party presence. Open and notorious conduct...
Well, but it also encompasses other things.
Sure, I mean, open and
like, you know, hanging the sheet or doing it in a public area even if nobody walks in.
Sure. Open and notorious conduct encompasses when there are people actually literally there, or in theory, it's reasonably likely that somebody could walk into it. So, no, open and notorious conduct doesn't necessarily require that third person. A review of case law indicates that it almost requires it, but there has to be a very, very high likelihood that another person will walk into it. Here, there was no notice of actual third-party presence or a reasonable likelihood.
You're arguing that doing it in a bedroom shared with two others who can walk in at any time isn't enough?
No, Your Honor. Our appellant agrees that it is legally sufficient for an indecent act with another or open...
It's legally sufficient to constitute open and notorious conduct.
Yes.
Under
the case law...
That's all I'm asking.
You're arguing notice,
You're arguing notice.
Like, the test here is not whether these facts are legally sufficient. I believe that's clear from the case of Dunn and Chiarella and Riley. The facts on the record may be legally sufficient. The question is, was there notice and what theory did the government present? Here, there was no notice from the get-go because the statute doesn't provide notice, nor does the pleading, as drafted in this case, provide notice. So there is no notice the day they walk in trial. And the alternative, even if the government, the appellant argues the government didn't even have the chance to argue this, but if they did, they didn't even attempt to. They didn't present evidence through opening, through closing, through witnesses, nor did they attempt to tailor the instruction to get this theory into trial. So even if we want to say they had that opportunity, they failed to take that opportunity. So there's no evidence that the jury would even consider this as a theory or that they would have convicted him on it. So the main point comes down to notice. And if we start from the beginning and we go all the way to the end, this theory of open and notorious conduct or third-party presence was just not, the government did not avail itself of it. They just did not present it. And an appellate court cannot affirm a conviction on a theory where there was no notice or that was not presented at trial. If the court has no further questions on issue one, we'll move on to issue two. The second issue involves whether the lower court erred by reassessing an appellate sentence as opposed to remanding for a sentence rehearing. Assuming that the lower court was even correct and affirmed the LAO, they abused their discretion when they reassessed the sentence as opposed to remanding it. And the primary factor for that here is because there was a dramatic change in the penalty landscape. When the lower court found factually insufficient the indecent assault and proved the indecent act, there was no longer a violent offense at play. We're talking now about a consensual act as opposed to a violent assault. This fact by itself would be a major consideration for members when considering whether punitive discharge may be appropriate. It could also affect the aggravated evidence that could have been presented.
Are members better suited or not than CCA judges to determine what is indecent or open and notorious in military context?
That's an interesting question, which I don't believe this issue turns on. I feel the members here, under Article 25, Sergeant McCracken elected to be sentenced by members. So arguably, there's a due process concern that...
You're answering the question you want to answer. What's the answer to my question?
Yes, Your Honor. But whether something is indecent...
Did you get rebuttal? You can answer it on rebuttal if you want more time to think of an answer. The question is... are members better suited than CCA judges to determine what
arguably, if you look at the definition, if you look at the definition of indecent, that it's obscene, it's vulgar, it violates common propriety. Arguably, that's a community type standard, and a panel of members with different perspectives and different views of the community. Arguably, they're in a better position to determine what they feel is indecent.
How do you reconcile all the sales, Suzuki, etc. apparatus?
I feel
with the Supreme Court's decision in Jackson v. Taylor.
I did not read Jackson v. Taylor.
Okay.
To do a supplemental briefing for you on that one. Right. Right. But just as a general point, the appellant is not arguing that we need to change the law here. Under sales and under all the preceding cases after Buber and Ebersol, that under that framework, that you look to the different factors. We look here to the penalty landscape. And under, by viewing the penalty landscape and the effect that removing the LIO or approving a different LIO, which is a conceptual LIO, that would cause the members to not be able to reliably predict, cause the appellate judges to not be able to reliably predict. If they can't reliably predict, then they can't determine what would be the least severe sentence. So under the sales test, in this case, they wouldn't be able to do so, because appellate judges have a different perspective than members, and we're talking about reasonable members could come down differently whether a punitive discharge should be awarded in a situation where one Marine is being charged with a trial and another Marine is continuing with her career. There's a reasonable question of fact what would be an appropriate sentence in this case, and that combined with the fact the elected members is enough that the fair thing to do, or the proper thing to do, is to remand it back to the members to make that ultimate determination.
Is that the test, whether it's fair or proper? What's the specific test that we apply in reviewing the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals to reassess a sentence?
It would be sales, Your Honor, and you would look to whether they abuse their discretion or if there was a miscarriage of justice.
Thank you.
To determine that, you look at the different factors, President Buber, Ebersol, and Moffitt. I see I'm running out of time. If there are no further questions,
you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, I'm Colonel Lou Puglio, along with Jeffrey Shows. I represent the United States. There are three requirements that an appellate court must consider if it wishes to find and affirm a lesser-included offense on appeal. The first is the lesser-included offense must, in fact, be a lesser-included offense. The second is it must conform to the dictates of the Supreme Court precedent of Chiarella and Dunn. And the third is that the offense, the LIO they wish to affirm, is factually and legally sufficient. If it meets those three tests, then the court can exercise its power under Article 59B and affirm the lesser-included offense. The issue in this case is the application of Chiarella and Dunn and the concept of theory of criminality. A close reading of Chiarella and Dunn stand for this proposition. And the proposition is looking to the pleadings and the instructions, or the members restricted or otherwise forbidden from convicting the accused on a basis that the appellate court now wishes to use to convict the accused. Put another way, can the appellate court use a basis to convict that the members were prohibited from using?
Could you start with me with the first part of your test, which is that the LIO must be an LIO?
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your question.
Yes, you said that there was three things that we needed,
yes,
in order to affirm, and one was that the LIO must be an LIO, and then you skipped to the second one, which was that it must conform to Dunn and Chiarella. So would you start with how the LIO here is an LIO?
Specifically here, there are five ways that this court has identified five tests that this court has used to identify a lesser included offense. The first is found in United States versus Brinson, which adopts the Supreme Court holding of Ball versus United States, and that is congressional intent. did Congress intend for one to be an LIO, the other?
Well, why don't we go to the Schmuck Elements Test, and why don't we use that test?
The Schmuck Elements Test is predicated under Article 79. And the Schmuck Elements Test requires a strict match of the elements. Is the elements of the lesser-included offense a subset of the greater offense?
And do you agree or disagree that that's the test that we currently use?
That is one of the tests that this Court uses.
How is it different from the other tests?
The other tests are found in United States versus Foster. And United States versus Foster gives us this derivative offense analysis. And the test in Foster, especially geared to Article 133 and 134, tells us that the Court must apply the elements of the lesser included offense realistically to the elements of the greater offense. And we must decide rationally whether one is rationally derived from the other. So we match the elements on a rational and realistic basis. If that is the case, then you have an LIO. That is the third way.
So Foster does have what purported to be following Schmuck, correct?
Foster does fold into Schmuck in the sense that under Article 79, and I say what I say under Article 79, what I'm specifically talking about is paragraph 3 of Part 4 of the Manual of Court Martials, that B2 element, that is, the lesser included offense has all the elements of the greater offense, however, one is legally less serious than the other. That's what seems to the government to be the way Foster fits it into the Schmuck 79 analysis. So a close reading of Foster would seem to infuse this LIO in that explanation of B2, I think it is. And in Foster, if you recall, the element, the charge was sodomy. The accused was convicted of indecent acts and was ultimately convicted of indecent assault. And the Foster Court used that analysis to realistically apply and rationally apply it to say it's folding.
So how is the open and notorious element of the LIO in this case apparent from the charged offense?
I think it's not, but that doesn't matter. What the accused has to be put on notice of is not theories. The accused has to be put on notice of LIOs and elements. Members find LIOs and elements. They don't find theories. To sustain a charge, and this is United States versus Brown and United States versus Rodriguez, where this Court has said the members can go back with a variety of theories, but what's important is that they all find, two-thirds of them find the element to satisfy beyond a reasonable doubt. They don't have to agree to theory.
So your position then is that the open and notorious is not an element, it's a theory.
Yes, it's just a means by which the element is fulfilled. And Brown specifically talks about this. And it says the crux of the argument depends upon what facts you're talking about. Are you talking about facts that specifically go to an element, or are you talking about facts that just provide a means to fulfill the element, a means to commit the offense? Indecent acts can be committed in a variety of ways. One is open and notorious. The government knows of no specific case law that requires that the accused receive notice of theories. In fact, if you look at, and quite tellingly, if you look at RCM 906.5, a bill of particulars, in the explanation it says a bill of particulars should not be used to discover the government's theory of the case.
But here, when the military judge gave his instruction on the lesser included offense of indecent acts, when he went to the elements, he specifically referenced the fondling of the individual and then that it was prejudicial to good order. How in the world can the members then somehow be informed that that would include an open and notorious theory when they were not instructed on it, when the government didn't argue it in its opening or closing, and there was just kind of incidental references during the trial to the fact that there were others present?
The instruction for indecent acts just requires that the act, the indecency of the act, be described as lustful and notorious.
But you could instruct it as open and notorious.
You could if you wanted, but that's not the only way that an indecent act becomes indecent. If we look at United States versus Foster, United States versus Sims, and United States versus, I forget the other case. But when we're dealing with indecent acts, you look to totality of the circumstances. So opening the door is the place that the act is committed is but one means by which it's committed.
In this case, how was the defendant placed on notice that he would be required to defend against an open and notorious theory?
He was not specifically placed on notice, but it's the government's position that he did not have to be placed on notice.
But he could be convicted under that theory, is the government's position.
Certainly, he can be convicted on
that. And he did not have to be placed on specific notice of it.
All he had to, no, and all, to answer your question directly.
Doesn't that seem to be inconsistent?
Not at all, because again, it would presume that the government has an obligation to disclose its theory to the defense, and that's not what's required. All that's required is that the government provide the accused with notice as to the elements of the offense to which he is charged. And here, this court has said in Foster, in Tolucci, and in other cases, that when you have a rape, you necessarily have an indecent assault. And if you have an indecent assault, those elements are necessarily included in the indecent acts.
And what were the elements? What were the elements of the indecent acts in this case?
The judge instructed on the fondling, I believe. That the wrongful act was the fondling. I believe it was the fondling that he specifically instructed. But the members found specifically under the indecent assault that he pulled down her pants and shorts and attempted to penetrate her. Those are wrongful acts as well and could be deemed indecent under the circumstances.
Counsel, in addition to the notice issue, don't we need to be concerned, at least in some respect, with respect to, you know, what the members actually found? And so you're saying that the government doesn't need to let the defense know what its theory is, and that may or may not be the case, but don't we have to be concerned as to what exactly it was that the members thought that they were convicting him of? I mean, it's not exactly the same, but surely if the government's theory of criminality in the entire case was that someone was murdered with a gun, and on appeal, the CCA said, well, decided that that hadn't happened, but in fact he'd been, you know, murdered through immolation, don't you think that would be problematic?
Yes.
How is this different?
But as long as the members could have considered it, if let's say it was a gun, and later on they found the CCA found that it was perhaps by a knife. If there was no evidence of that, obviously it would be factually or legally insufficient. Or the other way to consider it is there a fatal variance between what was pled and what was proved at trial and what was ultimately found on appeal? I think that is one of the ways to analyze that case. But it still comes back to the question of what the notice requirement is. And you never know. We never know, because it is a general verdict jurisdiction, we never know under what theory the members have found the accused guilty. And again, I go back to the cases of Brown and Rodriguez and Vidal, and which all state that the members can take alternate theories, not agree on which theory fulfills that element, as long as they all agree that in the necessary two-thirds that the element is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what Brown stands for. And Brown is predicated on Griffin, I think, for Griffin versus United States, which is a Supreme Court case. So from the government's perspective, it's a question of, does the accused have a right to notice of the government's theory of criminality? I would merely go back
tying in with Judge Ryan's question, the accused may not have a right to the theory of criminality, but shouldn't the members have the right, or at least hear what it is?
The members have the
right is the wrong word, but in this case, the issue is whether the members ever heard this theory. And that's what the real issue seems to be, is not whether the appellant rated to hear the theory, but if it wasn't even presented to the members, how does it survive? When he elected trial by members.
Yes, sir. I guess it's a two-part answer. The first is, as long as the evidence is there,
Can I just ask a straight factual question?
Yes.
Is it the government's view that the members were presented this theory or not?
Yes, they were.
They were presented the open and notorious theory?
Yes, absolutely. The evidence is there. The evidence is there. The government doesn't have to make an opening. They don't have to make a closing. But the evidence is there to support that aspect of indecent acts. The members could have gone back and said, you know what? He did that in front of his
committee. So the answer to the question is yes, the members were presented with this theory, even though it was not articulated.
They were presented with the evidence, yes, sir.
So
that's enough.
Is what you're saying is that there were facts from which, if they were looking at the legal factual sufficiency, that they could find it, or are you saying that was the theory that was presented to them? Because they're two different things.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. They were presented with facts upon which they could find the accused, that they could find the wrongful acts were indecent, thus fulfilling the element of the crime.
But let's say, what you're saying is, well, no, it probably complicates it too much. I probably should go back to X and Y. as long as they were presented facts that demonstrated some criminality, it doesn't matter what they were told or instructed on. So if in the course of this thing, he was belching in public at the same time, the CCA could have affirmed on a discredit charge, because the members were presented with that's a LIO of indecent acts, and the members heard facts that could be discrediting, so why not? You follow?
I would ask you to repeat that.
That's me.
But I guess, let me try to, there was something that you said that really...
aside from the absurdity of my facts.
In this case, the members could have found the indecency based upon several. I don't know if I'm answering your question, sir, but don't I apologize for something?
Well, there's a difference between fact and theory, and it may not be a difference that changes anything.
Right.
But you're arguing, and I think you're conceding, but without stating it's not, without recognizing that it's a concession, and I'm not, that they weren't presented with the theory, but they were presented with the facts.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So does that mean the CCA can affirm any charge for which there were facts on the table?
As long as you apply the government's three-step analysis, was it an LIO? If it was, then certainly. Did it meet Chiarella and Dunn? And is there factual legal sufficiency to support the LIO? I think part of the problem, and let me just say this, the instructions are important, and the instructions have to be right, and here they were right. Now, the instruction on indecency, they weren't told the theory of open and notorious, but the members could have gone back and said, the presence of others, that was indecent. Or they could have said, the fact that it was done, deployed in a barracks room where others could
have. But isn't that the whole point of selecting members? Not the whole point, but a point of selecting members is I want the members to decide what's open and notorious. That's why I've selected them. I want my peers, or whatever we call them in the military, to determine these facts.
No, absolutely not, sir. The government disagrees with it. The selection of members is to find the element of the crime, indecency.
No, but from the accused selecting members' standpoint, I understand.
I understand what you're saying.
I understand where you're going, but the accused is saying, wait a second, I wanted the members to decide this. If I'd wanted trial by CCA, I would have selected trial by CCA.
I understand that, but the accused, I guess there's several answers to that question. One, the accused put on notice that he has to defend against indecent acts. Two, the accused has no right to have a body of jurors who would be amenable to his theory. Or the
and you double theory. Back to your three-pronged thing at the beginning.
Yeah, that's
the loop back.
That is a loop back.
Is what you're ultimately saying is that the fact that the members return a general verdict means we don't have to concern ourselves with how they got there as long as the evidence is out there.
Well, as long as it meets the three-part test.
Right.
As long as it is an LIO, TRL and done, and it's factually legal sufficient.
Okay.
I think the hang-up, if I may, I think the hang-up here is the application of Dunn and Chiarella and this concept of theory of criminality. Theory of criminality, if that title is trying to explain Dunn and Chiarella, the government's position is it doesn't. The Supreme Court used theory of criminality when it looked at indictments, vague and ambiguous indictments, that allowed the government, didn't put the accused on proper notice, and the case is Russell versus United States. And that's when the court used this concept of theory of criminality to say, when you have such a vague indictment that doesn't really put the accused on notice as to the elements of the crime, the acts that make up the elements of the crime, you allow the government to kind of wander around and throw darts and hope that it's going to get it. That's where they came from, with this theory of criminality. I think the confusion comes when you try to put that aspect of it into Dunn and Chiarella. Dunn and Chiarella have nothing to do with this concept of theory of criminality. All Dunn and Chiarella say, really, could the members have found the accused guilty of the LIO?
Well, wait a minute. I just have to draw your, after the statement that you just made that Chiarella and Dunn have nothing to do with the theory of criminality, on page 9 of your brief, you state federal law permits affirmance of lesser included offenses where the theory of criminality was presented to the members by instruction. And then you cite Chiarella. So, where is the conflict?
That is an artfully drafted. The theory of criminality.
So you're right now, but not then.
the concept of this, and the specific quote from Chiarella is, the appellate court cannot confirm a conviction based upon a theory not presented to the government. That's the sentence that everybody draws from Chiarella. But that sentence is the last sentence in a paragraph that talks about the instruction. And in Chiarella, the members were restricted and only told that this was the only act that they consider. And that's what the court in Chiarella had a problem with, going beyond the pleadings and the instructions to these other things, like the trial counsel's argument and all that stuff, goes way beyond Chiarella and Dunn.
But does the government agree that in order to be convicted of a lesser included offense, the theory of the offense has to be presented at trial?
No, the government does not agree. It only has to be a lesser included offense. The theory, the government could absolutely say nothing about the theory.
Well, okay. I think we've said that it does.
I see I'm running out of time.
You'll have time to answer Judge Erdman's question. I might have one of my own as a follow-up.
In Standiffer, the 1994 case, if the evidence is sufficient to establish an included offense, the court may affirm the included offense, provided that it does not do so on a theory not presented to the trier of fact.
And I believe that's like, if you're not, sir?
Yeah, I don't have that right here, yeah. But that seems to conflict with the position that the government has just taken.
And I would propose that Standiffer, and there's two cases that the court really used, broadened beyond the pleadings and the instructions. One is Holder, the other is Standiffer. And the government's proposition is the expansion of Chiarella and Dunn beyond looking at the pleadings and the instruction is just an incorrect reading of Dunn and Chiarella.
So that's an improper statement?
The government believes it's broad, and in fact doesn't conform to normal trial practice. Prosecutors get up and don't say, here's my case and it's rape. But by the way, three steps removed, you might convict him on this thing. Usually the government stands up and says, rape, 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 and allows the judge to instruct on the LIO. But
that seems to be a pretty clear statement, and I don't see where you've asked us to overrule it or clarify it or...
Well, to the degree I'm standing here
today, right now.
I would ask you to do so. Okay. But it should be noted that in this case, in applying Dunn and Chiarella, the defense counsel on page 11 of the joint appendix acknowledged that this was a public sexual act. And the defense counsel on page 118 and 119 of the Joint Appendix did not object to the Indecent Act, so it wasn't a surprise in that respect.
Counsel, in this case, again, we have a rape charge that then became an indecent assault charge, now an Indecent Act charge. And the rape charge was a charge of a physical sexual act. If this case had been charged as an indecent act at the beginning, what would have been the charge? Charged as some sort of physical act? Or the government could have charged it as some kind of public act?
I think a necessary charge would have been in that Sergeant McCracken did blah, blah, blah.
Touched her in a particular way?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Now let's assume, right, let's assume that that was the charge and that was the way that the case proceeded. That's the way the conviction took place and affirmed by the Court of Criminal Appeals, approved by the convening authority. In that situation, could the Court of Criminal Appeals or this court affirm an act, affirm a offense based upon the public nature of it, if that was not in the specification, not in the theory proved at trial, but it was simply in the evidence?
I think CCA could have looked at the evidence and said whether it's legally in their legal, and that's the legal and factual sufficiency part, and looked to see whether or not legally and factually it was indecent. That is, was one of the theories. It was was the proof that it was open and notorious. Another way could have been it was forceful, as court said in United States versus Forster on 147, that the force element, even though it may not be beyond a reasonable doubt, makes an act.
Exactly. So that if the case was tried and proved on a force basis, the government's position is that the Court of Criminal Appeals, if it did not find the force to be factually sufficient, could approve on open and notorious, even if it wasn't in the initial charge, wasn't instructed upon, and wasn't argued, but was simply somewhere in the evidence that other people saw this.
Yeah, absolutely, because there's a case that says that in order to find the LIO, the members don't even have to be instructed on the LIO, as long as it's a lesser included offense.
And your view is no notice is required in that situation, that the charge upon which the person might be convicted is one of engaging in open and notorious behavior?
Yes, sir. There's no requirement. The government's position is no requirements to inform the accused of the exact theory of criminality, if that's the wrong question. Okay. I would just note for the court that Hickson has been overruled in United States versus Hall, although on other grounds. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Just to borrow the government's three-part test, the government here wouldn't even make it past step one. Open and notorious conduct is not an LIO of rape. Indecent acts being an LIO of rape was articulated in the school field, and it was found to be an LIO because the elements are legally less serious, where you no longer have an act of intercourse, but a lesser degree of sexual conduct, and you no longer have an act of force, but a legally less serious act of coercion or something that doesn't rise to coercion. So you still have that force element, and you still have that sexual conduct element. To be an indecent act for open and notorious, you have those two, and you have the public nature or the open and notorious element to it. So it's not an LIO because there is an extra fact. So under the element approach, it's not an LIO. Under the pleadings, it could be, but obviously here is a short-form rape pleading, so the pleading does not save it. So you don't even get past step one. Even if you want to move on to step two, it seems that step two is a combination of the inherent relationship test and some kind of legal sufficiency argument. Obviously, the inherent relationship test was rejected in Schmuck and rejected in Teeters. So the facts as they come out of trial and the instruction, that doesn't create an LIO. So even if facts come out during trial, if it wasn't an LIO from the beginning, it doesn't magically become an LIO during trial because facts came out that could legally support it. And also, I believe it's clear from Dunn and Chiarella that legal sufficiency is not the test here. as it's directly possible the members could have gone into the deliberation room and it was in a public barracks room, that might be indecent. And done, they could have said, well, the date's in the indictment wrong, but this different date, well, that could make a criminal offense. Or in Chiarella, he may not owe a duty to sellers of that security, but he owes a duty to somebody else. In that situation, theoretically, the members could have created that theory on their own, but there's no reason to believe they did, because it wasn't presented and it wasn't instructed. Here, it wasn't presented to the members, and they weren't instructed that open and notorious could be an indecent act.
Can an Article 134, Prong 1 or 2 offense be an LIO of an enumerated offense under Schmuck?
Yes, Your Honor.
How so?
Because the 1 or 2, the terminal element, is necessarily included in every enumerated offense. So a general article is an LIO of any enumerated
offense. I thought you said the reverse just a minute ago.
If I did, I misspoke.
Okay.
I was talking about
thank you.
But because there was no notice in the pleading or from the elements, it was not an LIO. And because there is no longer an inherent relationship test, the facts that occurred at trial don't affect the analysis here. So that theory was not available to the jury, thus that theory cannot be available to the appellate court. If there are no further questions, I would conclude on this argument.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel, both parties, for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. Court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.